Crash, almost hitting the foot of the bed Jack Hamilton was dying in. Then he just lay there. I ran to him, brushing the white threads aside. At first I thought he was dead, because when I turned him over there was blood all over his mouth and his cheek. Then he sat up. He wiped his face, looked at the blood, then looked at me. "Holy shit, Homer, did I just shoot myself?" Johnny says. "I think you did," I says. "How bad is it?" Before I could tell him I didn't know, Rabbits pushed me to the side and wiped away the blood with her apron. She looked at him hard for a second or two, and then she says, "You're all right. It's just a scrape." Only was seen later, when she dabbed him up with the iodine, that it was actually two scrapes. The bullet cut through the skin over his lip on the right side, flew through maybe 2 inches of air, then it cut him again on the cheekbone right beside his eye. After that, it went into the ceiling, but before it did, it plugged one of my flies. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true, I swear. The fly lay there on the floor in a little heap of white thread. Nothing left of it but a couple of legs. "Johnny," Doc says, "I think I got some bad news for you, partner." He didn't have to tell us what it was. Jack was still sitting up, but now his head was bowed over so far that his hair was touching the sheet between his knees. While we were checking to see how bad Johnny was hurt, Jack had died. Doc told us to take the body to a gravel pit about 2 miles farther down the road, just past the Aurora town line. There was a bottle of lye under the sink, and Rabbits gave it to us.
"You know what to do with this, don't you?" she asks.
"Sure," Johnny says. He had one of her band-aids stuck on his upper lip, over that place where his mustache never grew in later on. He sounded listless, and he wouldn't meet her eye.
"Make him do it, Homer," she says,
then jerked her thumb toward the bedroom where Jack was laying wrapped up in the blood-stained sheet.
"If they find that one and identify him before you get clear, it'll make things just so much worse for you. Us too, maybe."
"You took us in when nobody else would," Johnny says, "and you won't live to regret it."
She gave him a smile. Women almost always fell for Johnny. I'd thought this one was an exception because she was so businesslike, but now I seen she wasn't. She just kept it all business because she knew she wasn't much in the looks department. Also, when a bunch of men with guns are cooped up like we were, a woman in her right mind doesn't want to make trouble among them.
"We'll be gone when you get back," Volney says. "Ma keeps talking about Florida. She got her eye on a place in Lake Weir."
"Shut up, Vol," Doc says, and gives him a hard poke in the shoulder.
"Anyway, we're getting out of here," he says, rubbing the sore place. "You ought to get out, too. Take your luggage. Don't even pull in on your way back. Things can change in a hurry."
"Okay,"
Johnny says.
"At least he died happy," Volney says. "Died laughing."
I didn't say nothing. It was coming home to me that Red Hamilton, my old running buddy, was really dead. It made me awful sad. I turned my mind to how the bullet had just grazed Johnny and then gone on to kill a fly instead, thinking that would cheer me up. But it didn't. It only made me feel worse. Doc shook my hand, then Johnny's. He looked pale and glum.
"I don't know how we ended up like this, and that's the truth," he says. "When I was a boy, the only goddamn thing I wanted was to be a railroad engineer."
"Well, I'll tell you something," Johnny says. "We don't have to worry. God makes it all come right in the end."
We took Jack on his last ride, wrapped up in a blood-stained sheet, and pushed into the back of that stolen Ford. Johnny drove us to the far side of the pit, all bump and jounce. When it comes to rough riding, I'll take a Terraplane over a Ford any day. Then he killed the engine and touched the band-aid riding his upper lip. He says,
"I used up the last of my luck today, Homer. They'll get me now."
"Don't talk like that," I says.
"Why not? It's true."
The sky above us was white and full of rain. I reckoned we'd have a muddy splash of it between Aurora and Chicago, Johnny had decided we should go back there because the feds would be expecting us in St. Paul. Somewhere, Crows was calling. The only other sound was the tick-tock of the cooling engine. I kept looking into the mirror at the wrapped-up body in the back seat. I could see the bumps of elbows and knees, the fine red spatters where he'd bent over, coughing and laughing at the end.
"Look at this, Homer," Johnny says and points to the .38, which was tucked back in his belt.
Then he twiddled Mr. Francis's key ring with the tips of his fingers where the prints were growing back in spite of all his trouble. There were four or five keys on the ring besides the one to the Ford and that lucky rabbit's foot.
"Butt of the gun hit this when it come down," he says.
He nodded his head.
"Hit my very own lucky piece. And now my luck's gone. Help me with him."
We lugged Jack to the gravel slope. Then Johnny got the bottle of lye. It had a big brown skull and crossbones on the label. Johnny knelt down and pulled the sheet back.
"Get his rings," he says, and I pulled them off.
Johnny put them in his pocket. We ended up getting $45 for them in Calumet City, although Johnny swore up and down that the little one had a real diamond in it.
"Now hold out his hands."
I did, and Johnny poured a cap of lye over the tip of each finger. That was one set of prints wasn't ever going to come back. Then he leaned over Jack's face and kissed him on the forehead.
"I hate to do this, Red, but I know you'd do the same to me if it had gone the other way."
He then poured the lye over Jack's cheeks and mouth and brow. It hissed and bubbled and turned white. When it started to eat through his closed eyelids, I turned away. And of course, none of it done no good. The body was found by a farmer after a load of gravel. A pack of dogs had knocked away most of the stones we covered him with and were eating what was left of his hands and face. As for the rest of him, there were enough scars for the cops to ID him as Jack Hamilton. It was the end of Johnny's luck, all right. Every move he made after that, right up to the night Purvis and his badge-carrying Gunsels got him at the Biograph, was a bad one. Could he have just thrown up his hands that night and surrendered? I'd have to say no. Purvis meant to have him dead one way or the other. That's why the G's never told the Chicago cops Johnny was in town. I'll never forget the way Jack laughed when I brought them flies in on their strings. He was a good fella. They all were, mostly, good fellas who got into the wrong line of work. And Johnny was the best of the bunch. No man ever had a truer friend. We robbed one more bank together, the Merchants National in South Bend, Indiana. Lester Nelson joined us on that caper. Getting out of town, it seemed like every hick in Indiana was throwing lead at us, and we still got away. But for what? We'd been expecting more than $100,000, enough to move to Mexico and live like kings. We ended up with a lousy $20,000. Most of it in dimes and dirty dollar bills. God makes it all come right in the end. That's what Johnny told Doc Barker just before we parted company. I was raised a Christian. I admit I fell away a bit along my journey, and I believe that. We're stuck with what we have, but that's all right. In God's eyes, none of us are really much more than flies on strings. And all that matters is how much sunshine you can spread along the way. The last time I seen Johnny Dillinger was in Chicago, and he was laughing at something I said. That's good enough for me.
That feeling, you can only say what it is in French. Read by Becky Ann Baker.
Floyd, what's that over there? Oh, shit! The man's voice speaking these words was vaguely familiar, but the words themselves were just a disconnected snip of dialogue, the kind of thing you heard when you were channel surfing with the remote. There was no one named Floyd in her life. Still, that was the start. Even before she saw the little girl in the red pinafore, there were those disconnected words. But it was the little girl who brought it on strong. "Uh-oh, I'm getting that feeling," Carol said. The girl in the pinafore was in front of a country market called Carson's. Beer, wine, groceries, fresh bait, lottery. Crouched down with her butt between her ankles and the bright red apron dress tucked between her thighs, playing with a doll. The doll was yellow-haired and dirty, the kind that's round and stuffed and boneless in the body. "What feeling?" Bill asked. "You know, the one you can only say what it is in French. Help me here." "Déjà vu," he said. "That's it," she said, and turned to look at the little girl one more time. She'll have the doll by one leg, Carol thought, holding it upside down by one leg with its grimy yellow hair hanging down. But the little girl had abandoned the doll on the store's splintery gray steps and had gone over to look at a dog caged up in the back of a station wagon. Then Bill and Carol Shelton went around a curve in the road, and the store was out of sight. "How much farther?" Carol asked. Bill looked at her with one eyebrow raised and his mouth dimpled at one corner. Left eyebrow, right dimple, always the same. The look that said, "You think I'm amused, but I'm really irritated. For the 90 trillionth or so time in the marriage, I'm really irritated. You don't know that, though, because you can only see about 2 inches into me, and then your vision fails." But she had better vision than he realized. It was one of the secrets of the marriage. Probably he had a few secrets of his own, and there were, of course, the ones they kept together. "I don't know," he said. "I've never been here." "But you're sure we're on the right road?" "Once you get over the causeway and onto Sanibel Island, there's only one," he said. "It goes across to Captiva, and there it ends. But before it does, we'll come to Palm House. That, I promise you." The arch in his eyebrow began to flatten. The dimple began to fill in. He was returning to what she thought of as the Great Level. She had come to dislike the Great Level, too, but not as much as the eyebrow and the dimple, or his sarcastic way of saying, "Excuse me?" when you said something he considered stupid, or his habit of pooching out his lower lip when he wanted to appear thoughtful and deliberative. "Bill?" "Do you know anyone named Floyd?" "There was Floyd Denning. He and I ran the downstairs snack bar at Christ the Redeemer in our senior year. I told you about him, didn't I? He stole the Coke money one Friday and spent the weekend in New York with his girlfriend. They suspended him and expelled her." "What made you think of him?" "I don't know," she said. Easier than telling him that the Floyd with whom Bill had gone to high school wasn't the Floyd the voice in her head was speaking to. At least she didn't think it was. Second honeymoon. That's what you call this, she thought, looking at the palms that lined Highway 867. A white bird that stalked along the shoulder like an angry preacher, and a sign that read, "Seminole Wildlife Park. Bring a carful for $10. Florida, the sunshine state. Florida, the hospitality state. Not to mention, Florida, the second honeymoon state. Florida, where Bill Shelton and Carol Shelton, the former Carol O'Neill of Lynn, Massachusetts, came on their first honeymoon 25 years before. Only that was on the other side, the Atlantic side, at a little cabin colony, and there were cockroaches in the bureau drawers. "He couldn't stop touching me," That was all right, though, in those days. I wanted to be touched. Hell, I wanted to be torched like Atlanta and Gone with the Wind. And he torched me, rebuilt me, torched me again. Now it's silver. 25 is silver. And sometimes I get that feeling. They were approaching a curve, and she thought, three crosses on the right side of the road, two small ones flanking a bigger one. The small ones are clapped together wood. The one in the middle is white birch, with a picture on it, a tiny photograph of the 17-year-old boy who lost control of his car on this curve one drunk night. That was his last drunk night. And this is where his girlfriend and her girlfriends marked the spot. Bill drove around the curve. A pair of black crows, plump and shiny, lifted off from something pasted to the macadam in a splat of blood. The birds had eaten so well that Carol wasn't sure they were going to get out of the way until they did. There were no crosses, not on the left, not on the right. Just roadkill in the middle. A woodchuck or something, now passing beneath a luxury car that had never been north of the Mason-Dixon line. Floyd, what's that over there? What's wrong? Huh? She looked at him bewildered, feeling a little wild. You're sitting bolt upright. Got a cramp in your back? Just a slight one. She settled back by degrees. I had that feeling again. The déjà vu.
Is it gone?
Yes, she said, but she was lying. It had retreated a little, but that was all. She'd had this before, but never so continuously. It came up and went down, but it didn't go away. She'd been aware of it ever since that thing about Floyd started knocking around in her head, and then the little girl in the red pinafore. But really, hadn't she felt something before either of those things? Hadn't it actually started when they came down the steps of the Lear 35 into the hammering heat of the Fort Myers sunshine? Or even before, en route from Boston? They were coming to an intersection. Overhead was a flashing yellow light, and she thought, to the right is a used car lot and a sign for the Sanibel Community Theater. Then she thought, no, it'll be like the crosses that weren't there. It's a strong feeling, but a false feeling. Here was the intersection. On the right, there was a used car lot, Palmdale Motors. Carol felt a real jump at that, a stab of something sharper than disquiet. She told herself to quit being stupid. There had to be car lots all over Florida, and if you predicted one at every intersection, sooner or later the law of averages made you a profit. It was a trick mediums had been using for hundreds of years. Besides, there's no theater sign. But there was another sign. It was Mary, the Mother of God, the ghost of all her childhood days, holding out her hands the way she did on the medallion Carol's grandmother had given her for her 10th birthday. Her grandmother had pressed it into her hand and looped the chain around her fingers, saying, "Wear her always as you grow. Because all the hard days are coming." She had worn it all right. At Our Lady of Angels Grammar and middle schools she had worn it, then at St. Vincent de Paul High. She wore the medal until breasts grew around it like ordinary miracles, and then someplace, probably on the class trip to Hampton Beach, she had lost it. Coming home on the bus, she had tongue-kissed for the first time. Butch Soucy had been the boy, and she'd been able to taste the cotton candy he'd eaten. Mary on that long-gone medallion and Mary on this billboard had exactly the same look, the one that made you feel guilty of thinking impure thoughts, even when all you were thinking about was a peanut butter sandwich. Beneath Mary, the sign said, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida homeless. Won't you help us?" "Hey there, Mary, what's the story?" More than one voice this time, many voices, girls' voices, chanting ghost voices. These were ordinary miracles. There were also ordinary ghosts. You found these things out as you got older. What's wrong with you? She knew that voice as well as she did the eyebrow and dimple look. Bill's "I'm only pretending to be pissed" tone of voice, the one that meant he really was pissed, at least a little. Nothing. She gave him the best smile she could manage. You really don't seem like yourself. Maybe you shouldn't have slept on the plane. You're probably right, she said, and not just to be agreeable either. After all, how many women got a second honeymoon on Captiva Island for their 25th anniversary? Round trip on a chartered Learjet? 10 days at one of those places where your money was no good, at least until MasterCard coughed up the bill at the end of the month. And if you wanted a massage, a big Swedish babe would come and pummel you in your 6-room beach house. Things had been different at the start. Bill, whom she'd first met at a crosstown high school dance and then met again at college 3 years later, another ordinary miracle, had begun their married life working as a janitor because there were no openings in the computer industry. It was 1973, and computers were essentially going nowhere, and they were living in a grotty place in Revere, not on the beach, but close to it, and all night people kept going up the stairs to buy drugs from the two sallow creatures who lived in the apartment above them and listened endlessly to dopey records from the 60s. Carol used to lie awake waiting for the shouting to start, thinking, "We won't ever get out of here. We'll grow old and die within earshot of Cream and Blue Cheer and the Dodgem cars down on the beach." Bill, exhausted at the end of his shift, would sleep through the noise lying on his side, sometimes with one hand on her hip, and when it wasn't there, she often put it there, especially if the creatures upstairs were arguing with their customers. Bill was all she had. Her parents had practically disowned her when she married him. He was a Catholic, but the wrong sort of Catholic. Graham had asked why she wanted to go with that boy when anyone could tell he was shanty. How could she fall for all his foolish talk? Why did she want to break her father's heart? And what could she say? It was a long distance from that place in Revere to a private jet soaring at 41,000 feet. A long way to this rental car, which was a Crown Victoria, what the Goodfellas in the gangster movies invariably called a Crown Vic, heading for 10 days in a place where the tab would probably be, well, she didn't even want to think about it. Floyd. Oh, shit. Carol, what is it now? Nothing, she said. Up ahead by the road was a little pink bungalow, the porch flanked by palms. Seeing those trees with their fringy heads lifted against the blue sky made her think of Japanese Zeros coming in low, their underwing machine guns firing. Such an association, clearly the result of a youth misspent in front of the TV. And as they passed, a black woman would come out. She would be drying her hands on a piece of pink toweling and would watch them expressionlessly as they passed. Rich folks in a Crown Vic headed for Captiva, and she'd have no idea that Carol Shelton once lay awake in a $90-a-month apartment, listening to the records and the drug deals upstairs, feeling something alive inside her, something that made her think of a cigarette that had fallen down behind the drapes at a party, small and unseen, but smoldering away next to the fabric. "Hun?" "Nothing," I said. They passed the house. There was no woman. An old man, white, not black, sat in a rocking chair, watching them pass. There were rimless glasses on his nose and a piece of ragged pink toweling, the same shade as the house, across his lap. "I'm fine now. Just anxious to get there and change into some shorts." His hand touched her hip, where he had so often touched her during those first days, and then crept a little farther inland. She thought about stopping him. Roman hands and Russian fingers, they used to say, and didn't. They were, after all, on their second honeymoon. Also, it would make that expression go away. "Maybe," he said, "we could take a pause, you know, after the dress comes off and before the shorts go on." "I think that's a lovely idea," she said, and put her hand over his, pressed both more tightly against her. Ahead was a sign that would read Palm House 3 miles on left, when they got close enough to see it. The sign actually read Palm House 2 miles on left. Beyond it was another sign, Mother Mary again, with her hands outstretched, and that little electric shimmy that wasn't quite a halo around her head. This version read, Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida sick. Won't you help us? Bill said, the next one ought to say Burma Shave. She didn't understand what he meant, but it was clearly a joke, and so she smiled. The next one would say, Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida hungry, but she couldn't tell him that. Dear Bill. Dear in spite of his sometimes stupid expressions and his sometimes unclear allusions. He'll most likely leave you, and you know something? If you go through with it, that's probably the best luck you can expect. This according to her father. Dear Bill, who had proved that just once, just that one crucial time, her judgment had been far better than her father's. She was still married to the man her Graham had called the big boaster. At a price, true, but what was that old axiom? God says, take what you want and pay for it. Her head itched. She scratched at it absently, watching for the next Mother of Mercy billboard. Horrible as it was to say, things had started turning around when she lost the baby. That was just before Bill got a job with Beach Computers out on Route 128. That was when the first winds of change in the industry began to blow. Lost the baby. Had a miscarriage. They all believed that, except maybe Bill. Certainly her family had believed it. Dad, Mom, Graham. Miscarriage was the story they told. Miscarriage was a Catholic story, if ever there was one. Hey, Mary, what's the story? They had sometimes sung when they skipped rope, feeling daring, feeling sinful, the skirts of their uniforms flipping up and down over their scabby knees. That was at Our Lady of Angels, where Sister Annunciata would spank your knuckles with her ruler if she caught you gazing out the window during sentence time. Where Sister Dormitilla would tell you that 1,000,000 years was the first tick of eternity's endless clock, and you could spend eternity in hell. Most people did. It was easy. In hell, you would live forever with your skin on fire and your bones roasting. Now she was in Florida. Now she was in a Crown Vic sitting next to her husband, whose hand was still in her crotch. The dress would be wrinkled. But who cared if it got that look off his face? And why wouldn't the feeling stop? She thought of a mailbox with Raglan painted on the side and an American flag decal on the front, and although the name turned out to be Reagan and the flag a Grateful Dead sticker, the box was there. She thought of a small black dog trotting briskly along the other side of the road, its head down, sniffling, and the small black dog was there. She thought again of the billboard, and yes, there it was. Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida hungry. Won't you help us? Bill was pointing. There, see? I think that's Palm House. No, not where the billboard is, the other side. Why did they let people put those things up out here anyway? I don't know. Her head itched. She scratched, and black dandruff began falling past her eyes. She looked at her fingers and was horrified to see dark smudges on the tips. It was as if someone had just taken her fingerprints. Bill? She raked her hand through her blonde hair, and this time the flakes were bigger. She saw they were not flakes of skin, but flakes of paper. There was a face on one, peering out of the char like a face peering out of a botched negative. Bill? What? Then a total change in his voice, and that frightened her more than the way the car swerved. Christ, honey, what's in your hair? The face appeared to be Mother Teresa's, or was that just because she'd been thinking about Our Lady of Angels? Carol plucked it from her dress, meaning to show it to Bill, and it crumpled between her fingers before she could. She turned to him and saw that his glasses were melted to his cheeks. One of his eyes had popped from its socket and then split like a grape pumped full of blood.
And I knew it, she thought. Even before I turned, I knew it. Because I had that feeling.
A bird was crying in the trees. On the billboard, Mary held out her hands. Carol tried to scream. Tried to scream. Carol? It was Bill's voice, coming from 1,000 miles away. Then his hand, not pressing the folds of her dress into her crotch, but on her shoulder. You okay, babe? She opened her eyes to brilliant sunlight and her ears to the steady hum of the Learjet's engines. And something else, pressure against her eardrums. She looked from Bill's mildly concerned face to the dial below the temperature gauge in the cabin and saw that it had wound down to 28,000. Landing? She said, sounding muzzy to herself. Already? It's fast, huh? Sounding pleased, as if he had flown it himself instead of only paying for it. Pilot says we'll be on the ground in Fort Myers in 20 minutes. You took a hell of a jump, girl. I had a nightmare. He laughed, the plummy ain't you the silly Billy laugh she had come really to detest. No nightmares allowed on your second honeymoon, babe. What was it? I don't remember, she said, and it was the truth. There were only fragments. Bill with his glasses melted all over his face, and one of the 3 or 4 forbidden skip rhymes they had sometimes chanted back in 5th and 6th grade. This one had gone, hey there, Mary, what's the story? And then something, something, something. She couldn't come up with the rest. She could remember jangle, tangle, jingle, bingle. I saw Daddy's great big dingle, but she couldn't remember the one about Mary. Mary helps the Florida sick, she thought, with no idea of what the thought meant. And just then there was a beep as the pilot turned the seatbelt light on. They had started their final descent. Let the wild rumpus start, she thought, and tightened her belt. You really don't remember? He asked, tightening his own. The little jet ran through a cloud filled with bumps. One of the pilots in the cockpit made a minor adjustment, and the ride smoothed out again. Because usually, just after you wake up, you can still remember, even the bad ones. I remember Sister Nunciata from Our Lady of Angels, sentence time. Now that's a nightmare. 10 minutes later, the landing gear came down with a whine and a thump. 5 minutes after that, they landed. They were supposed to bring the car right out to the plane, Bill said, already starting up the type A shit. This she didn't like, but at least she didn't detest it the way she detested the plummy laugh and his repertoire of patronizing looks. I hope there hasn't been a hitch. There hasn't been, she thought, and the feeling swept over her full force. I'm going to see it out the window on my side in just a second or two. It's your total Florida vacation car, a great big white goddamn Cadillac, or maybe it's a Lincoln. And yes, here it came, proving what? Well, she supposed it proved that sometimes when you had deja vu, what you thought was going to happen next really did. It wasn't a Caddy or a Lincoln after all, but a Crown Victoria, what the gangsters in a Martin Scorsese film would doubtless call a Crown Vic. Woo, she said, as he helped her down the steps and off the plane. The hot sun made her feel dizzy. What's wrong? Nothing, really. I've got deja vu, left over from my dream, I guess. We've been here before, that kind of thing. It's being in a strange place, that's all, he said, and kissed her cheek. Come on. Let the wild rumpus start. They went to the car. Bill showed his driver's license to the young woman who had driven it out. Carol saw him check out the hem of her skirt, then sign the paper on her clipboard. She's going to drop it, Carol thought. The feeling was now so strong it was like being on an amusement park ride that goes just a little too fast. All at once you realize you're edging out of the land of fun and into the kingdom of nausea. She'll drop it, and Bill will say, "Whoopsie-daisy," and pick it up for her, get an even closer look at her legs. But the Hertz woman didn't drop the clipboard. A white courtesy van had appeared to take her back to the Butler Aviation Terminal. She gave Bill a final smile, Carol she had ignored completely, and opened the front passenger door. She stepped up, then slipped. "Whoopsie-daisy, don't be crazy," Bill said, and took her elbow, steadying her. She gave him a smile, he gave her well-turned legs a goodbye look, and Carol stood by the growing pile of their luggage and thought, "Hey there, Mary." "Mrs. Shelton?" It was the co-pilot. He had the last bag and the case with Bill's laptop inside it, and he looked concerned. "Are you all right? You're very pale." Bill heard and turned away from the departing white van, his face worried. If her strongest feelings about Bill were her only feelings about Bill, now that they were 25 years on, she would have left him when she found out about the secretary, a Clairol blonde too young to remember the Clairol slogan that started, "If I have only one life to live." But there were other feelings. There was love, for instance. Still, love. A kind that girls in Catholic school uniforms didn't suspect. A weedy, unlovely species too tough to die. Besides, it wasn't just love that held people together. There were secrets, and the price you paid to keep them. "Carol," he asked her, "babe, all right?" She thought about telling him no, she wasn't all right. She was drowning. But then she managed to smile and said, "It's the heat, that's all. I feel a little groggy. Get me in the car and crank up the air conditioning. I'll be fine." Bill took her by the elbow. "Bet you're not checking out my legs, though," Carol thought. "You know where they go, don't you?" And led her toward the Crown Vic as if she were a very old lady. By the time the door was closed and cool air was pumping over her face, she actually had started to feel a little better. "If the feeling comes back, I'll tell him," Carol thought. "I'll have to. It's just too strong. Not normal." Well, deja vu was never normal, she supposed. It was something that was part dream, part chemistry, and she was sure she'd read this, maybe in a doctor's office somewhere while waiting for her gynecologist to go prospecting up her 52-year-old twat. Part the result of an electrical misfire in the brain, causing new experience to be identified as old data. A temporary hole in the pipes, hot water and cold water mingling. She closed her eyes and prayed for it to go away. "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." "Please, oh please," they used to say. "Not back to parochial school. This was supposed to be a vacation, not..." "Floyd, what's that over there? Oh shit, oh shit!" Who was Floyd? The only Floyd Bill knew was Floyd Dorning, or maybe it was Darling, the kid he'd run the snack bar with, the one who'd run off to New York with his girlfriend. Carol couldn't remember when Bill had told her about that kid, but she knew he had. "Just quit it, girl. There's nothing here for you." Slam the door on the whole train of thought. And that worked. There was a final whisper, "What's the story?" And then she was just Carol Shelton on her way to Captiva Island, on her way to Palm House with her husband, the renowned software designer, on their way to the beaches and the rum drinks and the sound of a steel band playing Margaritaville. They passed a Publix market. They passed an old black man minding a roadside fruit stand. He made her think of actors from the 30s and movies you saw on the American Movie Channel. An old Yassir boss type of guy wearing bib overalls and a straw hat with a round crown. Bill made small talk, and she made it right back at him. She was faintly amazed that the little girl who had worn a Mary medallion every day from 10 to 16 had become this woman in the Donna Karan dress. that the desperate couple in that Revere apartment were these middle-aged rich folks rolling down a lush aisle of palms. But she was, and they were. Once in those Revere days, he had come home drunk, and she had hit him and drawn blood from below his eye. Once she had been in fear of hell, had lain half-drugged in steel stirrups, thinking, "I'm damned. I've come to damnation, 1,000,000 years, and that's only the first tick of the clock." They stopped at the Causeway toll booth, and Carol thought, the toll taker has a strawberry birthmark on the left side of his forehead, all mixed in with his eyebrow. There was no mark. The toll taker was just an ordinary guy in his late 40s or early 50s, iron gray hair and a buzz cut, horn-rimmed specs, the kind of guy who says, "Y'all have a nice time, okay?" But the feeling began to come back, and Carol realized that now the things she thought she knew were things she really did know. At first, not all of them. But then, by the time they neared the little market on the right side of Route 41, it was almost everything. The market's called Corson's, and there's a little girl out front, Carol thought. She's wearing a red pinafore. She's got a doll, a dirty old yellow-haired thing, that she's left on the store steps so she can look at a dog in the back of a station wagon. The name of the market turned out to be Carson's, not Corson's, but everything else was the same. As the white Crown Vic passed, the little girl in the red dress turned her solemn face in Carol's direction. A country girl's face, although what a girl from the Tulies could be doing here in rich folks' tourist country, her and her dirty yellow-headed doll, Carol didn't know. "Here's where I ask Bill how much farther, only I won't do it, because I have to break out of this cycle, this groove. I have to." "How much farther?" she asked him. He says there's only one road, we can't get lost. He says he promises me we'll get to the Palm House with no problem. And by the way, who's Floyd? Bill's eyebrow went up, the dimple beside his mouth appeared. "Once you get over the causeway and on to Sanibel Island, there's only one road," he said. Carol barely heard him. He was still talking about the road, her husband who had spent a dirty weekend in bed with his secretary 2 years ago, risking all they had done and all they had made. Bill, doing that with his other face on, being the Bill Carol's mother had warned would break her heart. And later Bill trying to tell her he hadn't been able to help himself. Her wanting to scream. "I once murdered a child for you, the potential of a child anyway. How high is that price? And is this what I get in return? To reach my 50s and find out that my husband had to get into some Clairol girl's pants?" "Tell him," she shrieked. "Make him pull over and stop. Make him do anything that will break you free. Change one thing. Change everything. You can do it. If you could put your feet up in those stirrups, you can do anything." But she could do nothing. And it all began to tick by faster. The two overfed crows lifted off from their splatter of lunch. Her husband asked why she was sitting that way. Was it a cramp? Her saying, yes, yes, a cramp in her back, but it was easing. Her mouth quacked on about deja vu just as if she weren't drowning in it. And the Crown Vic moved forward, like one of those sadistic Dodgem cars at Revere Beach. Here came Palmdale Motors on the right, and on the left, some kind of sign for the local community theater, a production of Naughty Marietta. No, it's Mary, not Marietta. Mary, Mother of Jesus, Mary, Mother of God, she's got her hands out. Carol bent all her will toward telling her husband what was happening, because the right Bill was behind the wheel. The right Bill could still hear her. Being heard was what married love was all about. Nothing came out. In her mind, Graham said, "All the hard days are coming." In her mind, a voice asked Floyd what was over there, then said, "Oh, shit," then screamed, "Oh, shit!" She looked at the speedometer and saw it was calibrated, not in miles an hour, but thousands of feet. They were at 28,000 and descending. Bill was telling her that she shouldn't have slept on the plane, and she was agreeing. There was a pink house coming up, little more than a bungalow, fringed with palm trees that looked like the ones you saw in the Second World War movies, fronds framing incoming Lear jets with their machine guns blazing. Blazing, burning hot. All at once, the magazine he's holding turns into a torch. Holy Mary, Mother of God. Hey there, Mary, what's the story? They passed the house. The old man sat on the porch and watched them go by. The lenses of his rimless glasses glinted in the sun. Bill's hand established a beachhead on her hip. He said something about how they might pause to refresh themselves between the doffing of her dress and the donning of her shorts, and she agreed, although they were never going to get to Palm House. They were going to go down this road and down this road. They were for the White Crown Vic, and the White Crown Vic was for them forever and ever. Amen. The next billboard would say Palm House, 2 miles. Beyond it was the one saying that Mother of Mercy Charities helped the Florida sick. Would they help her? Now that it was too late, she was beginning to understand, beginning to see the light the way she could see the subtropical sun sparkling off the water on their left, wondering how many wrongs she had done in her life, how many sins, if you like that word. God knew her parents, and her Graham certainly had. Sin this and sin that, and wear the medallion between those growing things the boys look at. And years later, she had lain in bed with her new husband on hot summer nights, knowing a decision had to be made, knowing the clock was ticking, the cigarette butt was smoldering, and she remembered making the decision, not telling him out loud, because about some things you could be silent. Her head itched. She scratched it. Black flecks came swirling down past her face. On the Crown Vic's instrument panel, the speedometer froze at 16,000 feet and then blew out. But Bill appeared not to notice. Here came a mailbox with a Grateful Dead sticker pasted on the front. Here came a little black dog with its head down, trotting busily. And God, how her head itched! Black flakes drifting in the air like fallout, and Mother Teresa's face looking out of one of them. Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida hungry. Won't you help us? Floyd, what's that over there? Oh, shit! She has time to see something big, and to read the word Delta. Bill? Bill? His reply, clear enough but nevertheless coming from around the rim of the universe. Christ, honey! What's in your hair? She plucked the charred remnant of Mother Teresa's face from her lap and held it out to him, the older version of the man she had married, the secretary-fucking man she had married, the man who had nonetheless rescued her from people who thought that you could live forever in paradise if you only lit enough candles and wore the blue blazer and stuck to the approved skipping rhymes. Lying there with this man one hot summer night, while the drug deals went on upstairs and Iron Butterfly sang Inagata De Vita for the 9 billionth time, she had asked what he thought you got, you know, after. When your part in the show was over, he had taken her in his arms and held her. Down the beach, she heard the jangle jingle of the midway and the bang of the Dodgem cars, and Bill... Bill's glasses were melted to his face. One eye bulged out of its socket. His mouth was a blood hole. In the trees, a bird was crying. A bird was screaming. And Carol began to scream with it, holding out the charred fragment of paper with Mother Teresa's picture on it, screaming, watching as his cheeks turned black and his forehead swarmed and his neck split open like a poisoned goiter, screaming. She was screaming. Somewhere, Iron Butterfly was singing Inagata De Vita, and she was screaming.
Carol? It was Bill's voice from 1,000 miles away. His hand was on her, but it was concern in his touch rather than lust. She opened her eyes and looked around the sun-brilliant cabin of the Lear 35, and for a moment she understood everything, in the way one understands the tremendous import of a dream upon the first moment of waking. She remembered asking him what he believed you got, you know, after. And he had said, you probably got what you always thought you would get. That if Jerry Lee Lewis thought he was going to hell for playing Boogie Woogie, that's exactly where he'd go. Heaven, hell, or Grand Rapids, it was your choice. Or the choice of those who had taught you what to believe. It was the human mind's final great parlor trick, the perception of eternity in the place where you'd always expected to spend it. Carol, you okay, babe? In one hand was the magazine he'd been reading, a Newsweek, with Mother Teresa on the cover. Sainthood Now, it said in white. Looking around wildly at the cabin, she was thinking, it happens at 16,000 feet. I have to tell them. I have to warn them. But it was fading, all of it, the way those feelings always did. They went like dreams or cotton candy turning into a sweet mist just above your tongue. Landing? Already? She felt wide awake, but her voice sounded thick and muzzy. It's fast, huh? He said, sounding pleased, as if he'd flown it himself instead of paying for it. Floyd says we'll be on the ground in... Who? She asked. The cabin of the little plane was warm, but her fingers were cold. Who? Floyd, you know, the pilot. He pointed his thumb toward the cockpit's left-hand seat. They were descending into a scrim of clouds. The plane began to shake. He says we'll be on the ground in Fort Myers in 20 minutes. You took a hell of a jump, girl. And before that, you were moaning. Carol opened her mouth to say it was that feeling, the one you could only say what it was in French, something vous or vous. But it was fading, and all she said was, I had a nightmare. There was a beep as Floyd, the pilot, switched the seatbelt light on. Carol turned her head. Somewhere below, waiting for them now and forever, was a white car from Hertz, a gangster car, the kind the characters in a Martin Scorsese movie would probably call a Crown Vic. She looked at the cover of the news magazine, at the face of Mother Teresa, and all at once she remembered skipping rope behind Our Lady of Angels, skipping to one of the forbidden rhymes, skipping to the one that went... Hey there, Mary, what's the story? Save my ass from purgatory. All the hard days are coming, her Gram had said. She had pressed the metal into Carol's palm, wrapped the chain around her fingers. The hard days are coming.
The Man in the Black Suit, Four Dark Tales, was written by Stephen King. It was read by Becky Ann Baker, John Cullum, Peter Garrity, and Arliss Howard. The recording engineers were Paul Fowley and Erica Weintraub, with editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The associate producers were Jessica Cassidy and Kelly Gilday. The Man in the Black Suit, Four Dark Tales, was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, from a Buick 8, Everything's Eventual, Five Dark Tales, Riding the Bullet, and Dreamcatcher.
all by Stephen King. The stories in The Man in the Black Suit, Four Dark Tales, appear in Stephen King's Everything's Eventual, available in hardcover from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.